We resume our study today in the second chapter of the book of Zechariah, Zechariah being one of the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, who were encouraging the rebuilding efforts of Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest. They had actually laid the foundations of the second temple in 536, but had, because of issues, let things lie fallow for about 15 years or so. Until now, in 520, God is insisting this needs to get done now. Get back to work so that the promises can be yours. Now, the prophet Zechariah is focused quite a bit on the idea that God is going to finish what he started, that he is going to accomplish what he intends, regardless of what's going on around. And so now, in the passage we're going to begin with today, he is urging more of the ethnic Israelis to come back to the homeland, back to the promised land, to leave the places of exile and resume their place in the covenant. So Zechariah chapter 2, verse 6 says, "Up, up, flee from the land of the north," declares he who is. "For I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heavens," declares he who is. "Up, escape to Zion, you who dwell with the daughter of Babylon." So God says, look, I sent you there in exile, but now I need you to head back home. Come back to the place of the covenant. Verse 8, "For thus says he who is of the hosts, after his glory, sent me to the nations who plundered you. For he who touches you touches the apple of his eye." So God wants them to come back from their place of punishment and to understand they have a special place in his mindset. And the way it's described here is that anyone that does anything against you, Israel, is touching the apple of my eye. The apple of the eye is the pupil. And so this poetic sense here is that Israel is constantly reflected in the pupil of God's eye. And so he is someone special. Israel is someone special to God. And it would be dangerous to mess with him. It's part of the Abrahamic promise. God said to Abraham, those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. Verse number 9. "Behold, I will shake my hand over them, and they shall become plunder for those who serve them. And then you will know that he who is of the hosts has sent me." So the tables are going to be turned, God says. It's going to be where the Israelis are going to be under the blessings of God, and those that cause trouble for them, including the Babylonians, are going to be coming under the curse. Verse 10, "Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion. For behold, I come, and I will dwell in your midst, declares he who is." This was the desire of God all along. And we see it in a lot of different prophetic passages that his ultimate goal is to be forever in the presence of his people. And of course, that is finally realized at the second coming of Jesus, at the creation of the new heavens and the new earth, and the gathering together of all the redeemed of all ages into his eternal kingdom. So this is something about Zechariah we should understand, is it's got a mixture of prophecies about the return from exile, and then the first coming of the Messiah, and the second coming of Messiah, and eternity that follows. So this is a hint at the ultimate goal of God is to spend eternity with his people. Verse 11, "Many nations shall join themselves to he who is in that day, and shall be my people." Now, I think that that is a prophecy about the inclusion of believing Gentiles into the inheritance of Israel. In Paul's letter to the Romans, he talks about the fact that the believing Gentiles are grafted into the tree of Israel. And so here is that prophecy again, that there will be many believing Gentiles mixed in with the believing Jews. I will dwell in your midst. You shall know that he who is of the host has sent me to you. And he who is will inherit Judah as his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. So Judah, the region around Jerusalem, God counts that as his special patch, his special farming area, his territory, his possession, his inheritance. And Jerusalem was going to be a special place in the midst of that. And so it's not surprising at all that we see many of these prophetic passages center around Jerusalem for the resolution of all things. Be silent, all flesh, before he who is, for he has roused himself from his holy dwelling. A little warning that when God starts to move things into the way he wants them, you had better stay out of his way. Chapter 3. Then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of he who is. So now we have a vision of the leader, the religious leader of these returnees, Joshua. And he is standing in front of God's angel, God's representative in the angelic court. Now, this angel of the Lord, some people think that this is a pre-incarnate Christ. I don't fall into that camp. I think that the angel of the Lord here is much more likely to be Michael, the prince of the covenant, the angel, the archangel, the ruling angel of God's covenant. But whoever it is, Joshua is standing in front of him, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. Now, Satan is the Hebrew word for accuser. So Satan is the accuser of the brethren. We hear that in New Testament passages. But here, he is accusing the high priest Joshua of not being fit for that office of high priest because he's a sinner. And so this is one of the ways that Satan causes trouble, is he drives a wedge or attempts to drive a wedge between the people and God. So the accusation here is that Joshua the high priest is a sinner and shouldn't have any type of interaction with God. And of course, that would cause trouble for all of the Jewish people since he's functioning as their high priest. Then verse 2 says, and he who is said to Satan, he who is rebuke you, O Satan. Now, this is one of the reasons why some people think that this is the pre-incarnate Christ, is because we have he who is speaking to or about he who is. And of course, Jesus is he who is, and he can speak about the actions of his Father, who is also he who is. And so that's why some people think that that's the case. I think it's possible that the first he who is here is missing a modifier that was already in verse number 1. That is the angel of he who is. So that it is the angel of he who says to Satan, he who is rebuke you, O Satan. And I happen to be of the opinion that this is the authentic source of the quote or the allusion in the book of Jude, where it talks about the that the angel of God, Michael the archangel, did not feel that he could personally rebuke Satan in regard to the body of Moses, but instead simply said, "The Lord rebuke you." I know there's a lot of people that teach that the Jude passage is about some sort of extra-biblical account of debate between Satan and Michael about the dead body of the prophet Moses. But I think it's much more likely that the body of Moses is a reference to the Jewish people, much like the body of Christ is used as a reference to Christians, because they're the followers of Christ. So the followers of Moses would be the body of Moses. So that concept would certainly fit here, because Satan is stirring up trouble for the people of Israel in the time of the return from exile, trying to reestablish themselves in the homeland, trying to reestablish the proper worship of God in Jerusalem at the new temple. He's trying to stir things up by causing trouble for the leader of that religious body. So he who is, or the angel of he who is, says back to Satan, "He who is, rebuke you, O Satan. He who is has chosen Jerusalem, rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked from the fire?" So, in my opinion, Michael basically says to Satan, "God will deal with you, buddy. God has chosen Jerusalem as the place where he is going to get things done, and he is going to rebuke you for getting in his way. This is just a fight you're trying to pick over one guy, a little bit of firebrand brought out of the fire. And you're not going to get it done because God is going to take care of Joshua." Now that's a lot of in between the lines assumption there on my part, but I think it's reasonable for what follows, because verse 3 says, "Joshua was standing before the angel," so we have the emphasis again about the angel, "clothed with filthy garments." So those filthy garments are representative of his sinful state as an individual. And so that's getting in the way of his work as a religious leader. Verse 4, "The angel said to those who were standing before him, 'Remove the filthy garments from him.'" So get rid of that junk, help him get all cleaned up spiritually, so that he can then serve God. "To him he said, 'Behold, I have taken your iniquity away from you, and I will clothe you with pure vestments.'" The high priest symbolically represented the people of God to God. Think about the high priestly robe. It had a chest piece with 12 jewels on it, or semi-precious stones and precious stones. Each one of those stones had a name of one of the 12 tribes engraved on it. So the high priest went into the presence of God on a regular basis carrying the names of the 12 tribes above his heart. On his shoulders, there were big stones of crystal that had, again, the names of the 12 tribes engraved on them, 6 on one shoulder, 6 on the other. So when the high priest went into the presence of God on behalf of the people, he carried the people's names on his shoulders. So he has them on his heart, he has them on his shoulders, he has pure robes, clean robes representing the holiness that's supposed to be of the people, because God called the people to be holy because he was holy. If the high priest has his own sins, he can't get the sins of the people dealt with until his own sins are taken care of. When Yom Kippur came around every year, the first time that the high priest went into the most holy place, he went in there to take care of his own sins. Then he would come back out and then return in order to take care of the sins of the people. So what we're seeing here is the angel of He Who Is, probably Michael the archangel, helping Joshua the high priest get over the hump to get past his own issues so that he will feel competent and confident to take care of the people's issues, because that's what the high priest needs to do. More reinforcement of that concept. Verse number 5. I said, let them put a clean turban on his head. And so they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments, and the angel of He Who Is was standing by. Now the turban was the head, the hat, the head covering, the hat for the high priest. Not altogether certain what it looked like. My best guess reading the literature from Scripture is that it kind of looked a little bit like a baker's hat. But more significant than the material of this turban was the fact that it had a golden plaque that was attached to the front of this hat right over the forehead of the high priest. And in raised lettering, like the lettering of a seal, on this golden plate, it said, Kodesh le Yahweh, holy to He Who Is. And so the high priest was sealed on his forehead with the name of God and the declaration that he was supposed to be holy to God on behalf of the people. So what we see here is the rededication of the high priest, Joshua, to the work of intercession for the people of Israel. He has been cleansed of his own sins, and he has been reclothed in the symbolic clothing of his office. And this is going to help in the reestablishment of the faith of Israel during their return from Babylon to the Promised Land. And God's angel, I believe Michael, their prince, is standing right there with him to make sure this stuff gets taken care of. Now, with that kind of in our pocket, let's go to verse 6. The angel of He Who Is solemnly assured Joshua. And maybe we should remember at this point, the name Joshua is just the Old Testament English equivalent to the New Testament, Jesus. It is the Hebrew name Yehoshua, He Who Is Salvation. So, this Joshua is encouraged by the angel with these words. Verse 7, thus says He Who Is of the hosts, if you will walk in my ways and keep my charge, then you shall rule my house and have charge of my courts, and I will give you the right of access among those who are standing here. So God, speaking through the angel, tells Joshua, if you will live the holy lifestyle of the high priest, I will give you access into my heavenly court. Verse 8, hear now, O Joshua, high priest, you and your friends who sit before you, for they are men who are a sign. Behold, I will bring my servant the branch. So now we get back into another prophecy from another book, Isaiah and Jeremiah in particular, that God had talked about the kingdom of David being cut off like a tree, being cut off because of sin. But eventually, from the stump of that cut off tree, there was going to be a new sprig, a new sprout, a new growth, this branch of the kingdom, of the royal family. this branch is the Messiah. He is the anointed future king. And so here is a promise made to Joshua that he is going to become symbolic in the coming of the branch. Verse 9, "For behold, on the stone that I have set before Joshua, on a single stone with seven eyes, I will engrave its inscription, declares he who is of the hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of this land in a single day." Now, they're building a house. They're building a new temple. And for the Jewish people, the last thing that happened in the building process was you put the dedicatory stone in place. We're going to be reading more about this stone later. So they always left this one last spot high up where they would slide this stone in place, and with the placement of that stone, the temple or the building would be completed. Jesus is referred to as this stone in many prophecies. And so this stone is in front of Joshua now, apparently because he's going to be involved in putting the blessing of God upon it before it's put in place. This is a stone that has seven eyes. Now, some people have guessed that that means it has seven sides to it. And if that's the case, you know any square or rectangular stone has six sides. So this would be a specially shaped stone where one of the original six sides has actually been brought out in its design so that it has two more sides to it. Maybe these sides would allow an inscription to be put on both sides so that it can be seen whichever direction you're passing by the stone. So that's a possibility. Here's the other possibility, that this is a design work that's put on the stone of dedication that has seven eyes of God represented as God keeping an eye on everything that's happening in the world. Now, I must confess to you, I don't know which of those is more likely to be the case. All I know for sure is that it is the stone that is focused upon here. And that God says, I am going to, through the work of the branch, through the work of the placement of the stone, take away the sin of this land in one day. So this symbolism here is definitely about Jesus, because we know that in a single day, the day of his crucifixion, Jesus took away the sins of repentant Israelis and repentant Gentiles throughout time. He is the branch. He is the stone which the builders rejected, which has become the chief stone of the building. So this prophecy here is all about Jesus. Verse number 10, "In that day, declares he who is of the hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to come under his vine and under his fig tree." Now that's a proverbial thing. When you're living in peace and prosperity, then you are reclining under your vine, enjoying the grapes, enjoying the wine made from the vine, or you're reclining under your fig tree, you're enjoying the figs, you're enjoying the relish, the sweet relish that's made from the figs. So you're enjoying the blessings of God in the promised land. The idea that every Israeli would eventually be under his own vine and under his own fig tree, that was a symbol of the ultimate eternal prosperity given by God's blessing. So God is going to use Jesus, the branch, the stone, in order to make it possible for us to invite everyone to come and participate in forgiveness and the blessings of eternity. chapter number 4. We'll just barely get started on this today since we've only got a couple of minutes left. But the symbolism we're about to see ends up being repeated in the book of Revelation. And it helps us, I think, unravel some of the symbolism in the book of Revelation. Chapter 4. The angel who talked with me came again and woke me like a man who is awakened out of his sleep. So poor Zechariah is like zoned out from all this stuff that he's seeing. And so the angel comes along and goes, hey, come on, there's still more. He said to me, what do you see? And so I said, I see, behold, a lampstand all of gold with a bowl on the top of it and 7 lamps on it, with 7 lips on each of the lamps that are on the top of it. What he just described here is the menorah, but a modified menorah. The menorah was the 7-branched lampstand originally in the tabernacle, and then later we have different styles of it in the Temple of Solomon. This lampstand was to give light into the worship area of the priests in the holy place. The 7 lamps were facing the center of the room, and they would have lips on the front of them where the wick would be laid, and that's where the light would be. Inside of all these lamps would be a reservoir for the top quality olive oil that would provide the fuel for that light. And this light was supposed to be going on all day long and all night long in the temple. Well, this particular menorah that he sees has a great big oil reservoir up on the top of it, feeding down into those lamps to make it possible for an even longer period of light to happen. And that's not even the end of it, because we're going to find out that there's an automatic feeding mechanism in place to keep the light shining always.